This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In 1984, the scholar and critic Alfred Kazin visited the Institute to talk about the long shadow Emerson cast over American and international literature. In this episode of The Vault, he discusses and defends his views of a writer who was critical to his sense of what American literature might embody.
First of all, Alfred, we're delighted that you're joining us for lunch today. Those of us who heard him last night heard him start on this procession of American writers, which he'll say a word, but he started his discussion last night talking about despicable Emerson.
I was telling him about my great difficulties with Emerson's piety, and I had developed this firm image of Emerson by virtue of the fact that I spent my formative years in Emerson Hall, Alfred, and at Harvard. And in Emerson Hall, there is an absolutely composed Emerson sitting in a chair, with his knees all burnished because people used to throw their coats up on him. And he looked so smug and self-satisfied. It was deeply distressing. It was so interesting that here was Emerson's essays. You get the beginning of a procession, and the next generation, the phenomenon of Hawthorne, Whitman, Melville, people who in many ways were concerned with matters which were so unbelievably demonic compared to Emerson's concern. And I was waiting for Alfred to talk a little bit more about the demonic that goes from the start with Emerson, who was, in a sense, the writer who's taken on the role almost as a priest.
I was talking about Emerson as the founder of American writing, and I was making the point, which is very obvious, that our literature as a national literature began in a religious revolution. And though Emerson had been a minister of the Unitarian Church, as had eight Emersons before him, successive generations, he was the first one who quit, and in quitting, made it clear what Whitman said about him later on. The priest departs, the divine literatus comes. My theme is the divine literatus. Not only did I not derogate Emerson, but I was trying to make the point, I'm afraid these days that most people are bored by Emerson. I never had been. For me, he's always been very much what he was for his own generation, which shows you also how old I'm getting. But the fact is that the influence he had upon Thoreau, upon Whitman, and what may be news to some of us on Nietzsche, for example, was extraordinary. As late as the Second World War, I was very moved in Paris to hear Albert Camus say that he never gotten over his first reading of Emerson in French. And Nietzsche, who, despite his great gifts as a classical philologist, some reason I did not read English, actually carried Emerson's works around with him from place to place on his nervous journeys in Northern Italy looking for help. I mean, Emerson, I sometimes think of him as the last American who saw God face to face. The problem about him is that he had this immense gift of conviction, which I don't think could have been shared exactly by people who didn't have it. He took it for granted that everybody saw what he saw and knew what he knew, as a matter of course. Fortunately, he was an extraordinary writer who was formed, as Lincoln was and others were formed, but of course he was much more sophisticated than that. He was formed by a great many interesting writers, but the style itself very much approximates the triumph of what I would call the biblical style. And of course, at the same time, Emerson had an amazing effect upon his generation. Although William Dean Howells said that as a young man, Emerson was sort of a folly figure, and he was the sport of small people writing paragraphs in newspapers. It is a fact that after a while, Emerson caught on so well, so much, that he became a sacred figure. That was part of the trouble, which led, I think, to that unfortunate statue in Emerson Hall at Harvard. In any event, I can't forget that after delivering the Divinity School address in 1838, Emerson was not invited back to Harvard for 20 years. The Divinity School address, one of the many essays which Lowell and others said they had heard as if they were listening to trumpets, had the most extraordinary effect upon people. The students at Harvard Divinity School in 1838 invited him to speak to them one Sunday evening. And he began, in his usual lovely way, speaking of the beauty of the summer and the harvest season that was about to come. And then suddenly he launched into this extraordinary idea of the cultus as being every free man's native gift as such. The ideas that went to Bertrand Russell's Freeman's Worship many years later, and which were put in a very despairing note, meaning that science has proved everything, but the free man still has to worship as he can. And Russell, that famous essay, of course, was being despairing. On the same grounds for Emerson was a pæan of joy and hope. And then he became more and more provocative, almost deliberately, and said one man was true to what is in you, and then he went on to speak that way of Jesus. Then he said, and finally a voice came down saying, I will kill you if you say he was a man, this is Emerson. The reports of the speech are that the students were besides themselves with wonder and amazement. Faculty or the Unitarians, the Unitarian priesthood attending them, stood around with frowning faces. But Emerson had actually, of course, made his separation from the church long before. But the fact is that it's typical of him, too, because with all of his terrible serenity, his terrible even-temperedness, the sort of thing which made William James late in life, when he first met him, say that the refined idiocy of his manner must be an affectation. Emerson was never known to deviate from that perfect Japanese Oriental equipoise for a second. People sometimes minded it. After all, Cambridge was to become the capital of the American nervous breakdown. This is all based upon a book I'm publishing in May called An American Procession. And the title itself, which comes from Whitman's tribute to Emerson, is significant here. Whitman said in his old age, after speaking about his extraordinary transparency, he said he was the actual beginner of the whole procession. He said, America in its future will know more vehement and more luxuriant writers, but no one like this one, the actual beginner of the whole procession. And of course, in terms of his provocative gifts, you have the great letter to Whitman in 1855, which emphasized the power, the daring that he got out of leaves of grass, which is amazing too, because Emerson, of course, recognized very quickly that one of the great underlying, very very close to skin motifs of leaves of grass is the sexual side of it. And later on, Emerson begged Whitman to take out that stuff in the second and third editions of Leaves of Grass. In the first one, he in the famous letter, he praised him enormously as such. Well, let me conclude about this with the tribute that Thoreau paid him. You know, Thoreau and Emerson had very ambiguous relations. First of all, Thoreau, with his famous independence, refused to take any kind of ordinary job in Cambridge. And Emerson was quite bourgeois in certain ways. The land that Thoreau occupied for Walden Pond was bought from Emerson or given to him. And he worked as a handyman for Emerson. And of course, it was part of his motif, part of his legend, to do things in unexpected ways. Emerson very quickly became the most famous citizen of Concord, whereas, of course, Thoreau, going back to his family's boarding house in Concord and having lived during that period in Walden Pond, took a great joy in being difficult. And the one thing Thoreau came to New York on the two times, he came because Emerson's brother William, who was a lawyer or a judge in Staten Island, needed a tutor for his children, and Emerson sat down with Thoreau. But Thoreau didn't like the place. We won't go into that. It was so obvious insight about New York. But Thoreau walking Broadway and getting out of the same animal pleasure that Whitman got out of Broadway is impossible to imagine. Thoreau did say about Emerson that he found in him the truths that were exact and trustworthy as those he found in outward nature. And this is the point, I think, fundamentally. Emerson in this period, a period when Romanticism was entirely a religious phenomenon, gave people a position feeling they had access to the truth. And that enabled his two most famous American students, Whitman and Thoreau, to write what they did, I think, in many ways. Whitman said about Leaves of Grass, I was simmering, Emerson brought me to a boil.
What did his family believe? What is that religious
The Unitarian culture? Movement was in England, and especially in America, under the leadership of the famous Channing, was a revolt against Calvinism. And it became very powerful at the beginning of the century. And of course, it became the official doctrine of the Harvard Divinity School. And in one way or another, Unitarianism, which unfriendly critics call the icebox Unitarianism, because it had a certain glacial quality. You know, it was very self-righteous that way. And one of the keys to Emerson's thought, one of the keys to Unitarianism, which of course was not only against the Trinity, but more and more unsure of any supernatural evidence, was Emerson's belief, this is in the Divinity School address too, that he raised an answer for his own satisfaction, the question, well, given the fact that we can no longer depend upon the supernatural evidence, given the fact that miracles don't exist except poetically, how can we believe that Christianity is true and truth as a way of life? He said, it's because we all carry in ourselves the moral sentiment. And that was the foundation. The theatrical side is very important. Remember that Emerson, except for his first book, Nature, and then except for his wonderful travel book, English Traits, one of the best books ever written by Europe, by an American, he very much depended upon the whole theatrical resource of the lecture. Even though he had to read these lectures and often got so bemused by his own writing that he sometimes lost his place, his daughter Ellen became so exasperated by his habit of not following the text that she sewed the pictures together once to make him follow them, but it still didn't help. The accounts of Emerson lecturing are extraordinary. On the one hand, you see this rather solemn figure who apparently still wore a ministerial costume when he lectured. And at the same time, he would just plunge ahead and read, you know, the time when there were no microphones, and people would sit there and obviously not understanding very much, not hearing very much, but sometimes rouse the most tremendous enthusiasm. And even when he lectured in California and other places, one of the newspaper reviews of the period said, a great tribute was paid to the first cause, which is the way, by this time, Transcendentalism had managed to put God down to the first cause. And the audience was aware that something like this, I don't have it exactly right, but the English language had never been handled before so well.
How do you think that marvelous poetic language, where had that come from?
Well, first of all, I don't know. I mean, properly speaking, no one knows the resource behind any gifted writer's style. I believe myself that from 1832, when Emerson left the church, up to the 1920s, when the writers of the 20s, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Scott, Eliot, made history by their incredible sense of style. But style was always the ruling factor with all these people. Because the greatest example of that in the middle of the century, later on, is Mark Twain. When you read Mark Twain and you read the great passages in Huckleberry Finn, you can only say, where the hell did Mark Twain learn to write like that? Now, Mark Twain, of course, was subjected to the Bible. All Americans, especially Presbyterians. He obviously didn't learn his kind of style. It had to do, in Mark Twain's case, by listening, but also the kind of jokes, the kind of retort always makes me think of the fastest draw in the West, but always giving it back, you see. A lot of it had to do with Mark Twain's need to defend himself in mining camps and newspaper offices and rest of it by being just a bit smarter than the other chap, you see. The great virtue behind Emerson's style is what I call his gift of conviction. The great thing behind Mark Twain's style is his sassiness and his skepticism. After all, only Mark Twain would have said, to quote only one or two of his most famous wisecracks, the calm compass of a Christian pause with four aces. At a time when there was a lot of anti-Semitism in America, people were constantly asking Mark Twain what he thought. He said, Jews are members of human race. Worse than that, I cannot say it. I'm not sure I know, Ruth, what this extraordinary gift of style is. I know that it's a foundation of whatever writing is.
Emerson's was something quite fresh, that kind of
book. Completely, that's the point. Though it's exactly, though it could not be less popular in its sources, like Mark Twain's, and though it is in many ways essentially bookish. Well, my own explanation of it, perhaps it won't carry conviction for many people, is that it's based upon the same amazing sense of spiritual truth which you get at the beginning of the Christian era, and which you find, despite the Latinate style of the Christian father and others, These people had a new vision. Revolutionary periods, which Christianity was and which America was very beginning, have that. You see it in Jefferson. You see it in Emerson. You see it in a great many Americans who in our time have, for some reason or other, learned not to write. It's the directness of it and the absolute knife edge with which he's putting it to the audience that's so striking about that. And, of course, the imagery. And then at the same time, it lay in what Lowell and other people thought of as this absolutely miraculous kind of power. Well, Nietzsche, who was a very great literary judge, said that Emerson was one of the four greatest prose stylists of the 19th century.
Do you think Emerson's style had an influence on subsequent major writers?
Eventually had a negative influence. That is, a great many writers at the time of the 20s now could not take Emerson seriously, precisely because the style had seemed to be too bookish, the rest of it. I don't think so, but Emerson's style as such influenced Whitman, because they're so different. Because Whitman, like a great many contemporary writers, knew how to depend upon his own animal fat, as it were. In fact, he said, you remember, I don't know any sweeter fat than that which sticks to my bones. It had to do, in this case, with the feeling that he was the apostle, that he saw things for the first time through a glass, clearly.
That produces part of what's so puzzling about the procession. Is if we take him as at the head of the procession moving along, the thing that's characteristic of so much of the writing that followed is that it's shot through with skepticism, with concern about even the nature of knowing, images in Melville at the very end of the Greek Lake at the top of the mast, this pagan crew searching for the white whale as a Christian symbol in a way. And even I'm surprised in the case of Nietzsche, who proposed such a thoroughgoing perspectivalism with respect to how one knows, admiring a man who thought there was no problem of knowing at all, directly in touch through a crystal.
Well, that's a wonderful question, Jerry. The answer is, I think, it lies in the sacred value he gives to the individual originality as such. What Emerson said was that the individual is totally self-dependent, self-reliant, the famous phrase. Above all, he is a force, he's a power. In fact, when you think about our age of nervous psychologism, when character often becomes a problem, you have to realize for him, character was always, first of all, a force. And the more eccentric the force was, the more it was to be dependent upon. Exactly the way in which Melville and Moby Dick finds every possible virtue of strength and power in eccentric, and even a mad people. Well, a good example, of course, has to do with Emerson's connection with Carlyle. Emerson went out to see Carlyle before Carlyle became famous. Carlyle became eventually a very, very bitter enemy of the United States. Carlyle was probably the most reactionary man in Europe after Joseph de Maistre. Yes. He thought that the Reform Act was simply based upon giving not the workers the suffrage in England, but small property holders. Yeah. And that fortunately, Carlyle was so provocative that he got Whitman to answer him in Democratic Vista. But Carlyle adored Emerson, and Emerson adored Carlyle, because they both thought of themselves as being powerful forces of nature, supermen. So he's sitting on the Himalayas, or looking down and everything else. Let's face it, Emerson is not a great Democrat with a small d. There is one case in this period of a great writer, and certainly in many ways a much more remarkable mind than Emerson himself, Herman Melville. Melville couldn't stand Emerson's optimism. He said about one lecture, imagine what stuff all this is for a man who has had to go around Cape Horn in a storm. He went on and on. And he especially found joy when Emerson, who expected America to just abound into perfection because people like Emerson were around, said bitterly in explanation of the American failure, which was already apparent to Emerson in 1945, he said, the calamity is the masses. And Melville wrote bitterly, of course it is, you know, and that's the way he talks, you see. But, said Melville, I love all men who dive. See, what these people are always concerned with is the great, strong, individual, picturesque character. And, of course, the lasting monument to what Emerson stood for is actually, I think, found not in Emerson's own works, but in Melville's creation of Captain Ahab in Moby Dick. The man who, as Melville says over and over again, is determined to go all the way out. When Melville wrote what we know or know of as the definitive version of Moby Dick, he did so because he was living near Hawthorne in Tanglewood. He was living at Pittsfield, 7 miles away. Hawthorne had a tremendous effect upon him in every possible way. In one of the many exultant letters he wrote to Hawthorne, he used phrases like, a man who goes through up to eternity, something like that, with nothing but his ego as a carpet bag, and who defies the forces of right and wrong, heaven and hell, that's the point. It's the enormous idea of personality and the supreme good in itself and by itself. And what is very striking in this connection is all there were people just as strong as these guys were after Civil War, like Mark Twain or Henry Adams. They did not associate their character with the same absolute firmness of belief as the
Alfred, doesn't it further complicate the question of style that in both Emerson and Whitman, they dramatically deny that what is produced is the thing itself, but rather the producer, the act of doing it?
Our generation, our age, especially those among us who teach, are very conscious of words, but we're conscious of them retrospectively and we're conscious of them analytically. Whitman wrote a primer called American Primer about American words. Emerson, of course, was an incredible user of words and very much aware of what words were, the size and length and strength of them. But it's typical of their age, you see, that the use of words was to instill conviction. Above all, it was to change people's minds. Whereas our use of words, especially in the academy, is to make students aware of it as such. And that is a great difference involved, you see. I mean, it would have shocked Whitman and others very deeply to think that one took words, shall we say, in a purely aesthetic sense, and such, even though they were very much aware of it. There's an extraordinary essay, perhaps the most beautiful and the most mystical that Emerson ever wrote, called The Poet, which is the greatest, in English, I think, the greatest dithyramb in behalf of the romantic poet I've ever read. And it has to do with the fact that the poet eventually bears supernatural knowledge, that he's different from our prose world and all the rest. But in Emerson's first book, Nature, he began by speaking of words and what he called fossil poetry. He thought that words by themselves were already fossil poetry. But again, each in those cases, the word in itself is a thing of tremendous power. And oddly enough, Emerson's tremendous elegance comes from a sense of power. But it has to do with the extraordinary idea that, well, it's what the great line of William Butler Yeats, belief makes the mind abundant. Now, obviously it's not true of all people with belief, but the people who had belief that age. It has also to do with tremendous revolutionary fervor behind Romanticism in America and in England, which did produce, after all, Keats and Blake, and did produce Hazlitt, and did produce in this country so many people, which had to do with the feeling, as Emerson put it, that man is coming back to consciousness, and that, as Henry James Sr. put it, the kingdom of man is at hand. These people had a sense of themselves which has not been seen in our age since those deceiving first moments in October 1917 in Russia, about which Mayakovsky and Akhmatova and many other Russians wrote so brilliantly, which of course always makes you think of Wordsworth's great line, bliss was not dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. Well, there's no question that it was very important for the country to be young too. It's a very much part of this contagion of enthusiasm.
It seems to me, for example, that Emerson doesn't help us at all with the theater or even with fiction. He had very negative feelings about prose fiction, Hawthorne's Marble Faun and Mere Mush, and aesthetic poets like Poe being jingling and so on. Isn't it the case that the real influence is essentially this moral effect of preaching self-reliance, self-creativity?
Well, you know, in the first place, it was not only Hawthorne who couldn't read. It was Dickens, it was Jane Austen, it was Scott. I mean, Emerson, the subject of fiction, is laughable. He couldn't read anything by Dickens very long. Thought it was trivial. He's very high-minded. And on poetry, he's terrible on Tennyson and others. But, of course, like many men of genius, he is unnaturally specialized in one direction only. Oddly enough, he's wonderful on writers of epic in the past, when he says that Dante's style is the nearest to hands and feet we've ever seen. That's a very profound remark about Dante's style, which not many people would grasp. The fact is also, you see, that Emerson was not so much a bad critic of writing in his own time. He was totally indifferent to it. He really thought that he alone understood what literature was about. And one reason why Emerson's judgment on literature, which I agree with you, seems so surprising in a man of his genius, that he couldn't take the literature of his own period seriously. He didn't take Thoreau seriously. He said, you know, that I recognize Thoreau and all my own ideas all the time, though Emerson would never have called himself an original philosopher in any way, since his own ideas came entirely out of Coleridge, Schelling, Plato, et cetera, et cetera. How shall I put it? We in our age, this is something which troubles me very much, we in our age constantly separate the scriptural, the aesthetic, the social. We don't realize that people like that in that time, there was no fundamental separation, at least not among the men who were men of genius, you see. I was amazed to hear that up at Yale, Emerson's great virtue is that he was an ancestor of Kenneth Burke. This surprised me. I think it surprised Kenneth especially. But the point is that there is he's not a critic in the sense in which people think of critics. I say not a man like Burke, who has employed his whole life thinking out certain, you know, aesthetic and moral questions. When Emerson is good, also he has the quality that all great critics have, which is that he makes says it's this way and not that way. And immediately in the journals and others see things right away. In English Greats, a remarkable book, he said even though he couldn't read Dickens and even though he's absurd about the Victorian age in many ways, he gets to the heart of English character, and he gets to the nature of what made England the wonder of the world in the 19th century in a way that correlates very much with Dickens. See what I'm getting? In other words, he doesn't write something which is purely explanatory and aesthetic, what people do in our age. See. We are all, understandably, under the domination of this separatism, which Eliot, among other things, made so famous. When Paul Elmer Moore, a now-forgotten conservative critic, first read T.S. Eliot, he couldn't believe his eyes, and he said he didn't like his poetry, but he did like his criticism. And he said, how can a man who writes poetry like this write criticism like that? And Eliot said, criticism describes the world as it is, poetry as it should be. Moore didn't write poetry, so he wouldn't have understood this in many ways. We also don't understand that the greatest critics have been the greatest creators. There's nothing as great in its way in criticism as Keats's letters. And they're very short comparatively. They're full of insight. They're the greatest things written about literature, written by people who were producing works of art. And things which they themselves later on didn't understand any more than the rest of the public did. Rilke said that works of art are of an infinite loneliness and with nothing so little to be reached as with criticism. But that would take our jobs away from us if we believed that. So one doesn't have to emphasize that too much. There is such a cult nowadays of criticism as method, of criticism as sobriety, that one forgets how many wonderful things are said in the spirit of Plato's banquet, tossed off in a mood of drunkenness, you see, and not in the spirit of wisdom as such. And Nietzsche, I think, appreciated this, and Nietzsche wrote extraordinary things without ever being a critic. The obvious irrelevance of Emerson and Thoreau to the world we're living in, Reagan's America, is so obvious that there's only one question remaining: why do we keep on reading them? And why do eccentric professors of literature like myself get a glow out of reading them? It can't be, because I hear them to be unrealistic. I mean, I am aware of the absurdities involved here, but Mark Van Doren also had a very beautiful book about Hawthorne, and Hawthorne was just as irrelevant to Reagan's America in that point of view. All writers are in that sense. So that the test of so-called irrelevance here seems to me wrong. Let me just say one thing for the double down. I want to make this very clear. In speaking of the critics, the romantic critics like Emerson, I was talking about the insights of the artist, not of the clairvoyance of the prehumanist then. What you get in Emerson's judgments about Dante and about other things, the same sort of shorthand insight that you get in great writers over and over again, you see. And even when they're wrong, as Nabokov was wrong in putting down Dostoevsky, or as Tolstoy was wrong in putting down Shakespeare, et cetera, et cetera, you get a flash of insight, which sometimes is more important than anything else. What fascinates me about the American procession is the fact that up to the end of the 20s, religion, even on the part of the most violent skeptics, atheists, was still a living issue. People took it very seriously. One cannot forget that in a period when Mark Twain was obsessed by America's imperialist role in the Philippines, was horrified by Theodore Roosevelt, thought that John D. Rockefeller and others were absolute brigands, that he spent much of his time, but he didn't have the guts to publish these things, parodying the Bible and trying to bring back Satan, not in the way in which Blake did, the land of heaven and hell, but to show that the Bible was simply wrong and that as the mysterious stranger, a book which we've just gotten in its proper unedited form for the first time, and Mark Twain died 73 years ago, which is in its new, when its original form says, in fact, the human beings are hopeless, that the moral sentiment is its most ridiculous boast and the enemy of happiness and progress, and that Satan's in the nephew looking upon human beings with lordly condescension and pity is the only proper judge of human actions. So the question is, why did these people, at this period when America became a great power, So people like William James and Mark Twain, others hated it and were fighting against what they felt to be the spoiling of the American promise. Why were they still preoccupied with religion? The answer is that a time would come, as in our own time, when it means very little to liberate people. It's actually, that they're not village atheists, they're not skeptics, none of that anymore. The opium of the people, as Karl Marx called it, means nothing, even to liberate men, unless they are very special types, like certain different Catholics, others who... No, I'm talking about this literary question. I have to admit, when I read Emerson, I get something of the same thrill out of certain passages in Linda's School Address and others that I get out of other scriptural books. But I wouldn't get that thrill if the man himself were not a master writer, the great gift of Stella. The reason for Emerson's influence was that he offered religious independence as a way of finding the truth. Remember that Thoreau quote, I found that Emerson proves, he said, you put it in the plural.
Plural,
that's right.
But the fact is, to put it, I don't want to be banal about this, but obviously the creative artist must believe that his position is one of truth. In the Romantic era, Blake said, truth cannot be uttered so as to be understood and not be believed. An amazing statement.
Yes, which no one would subscribe to.
No, but just amazing. What no one today can capable of writing is one of it. Perhaps not altogether capable of understanding. But that's an extraordinary thing, you see. And this is what Emerson gave people, the idea that they had, well, we would call it a position. We gave them a feeling that had a point of truth. And the poignancy, of course, Emerson's career is that at a time which we cannot reclaim in this overgrown, now, I think, strangely mindless country in many ways, he really believed that every man by himself could be assured of spiritual harmony and not recognize for a moment that this was a gift and that under the impact of science and technology, not to mention the Civil War, which really killed that kind of supernaturalism in America, that this was going to become more and more impossible, you see, in many ways. You know, contemporary writing is full of great talent, right? That we live in a period, too, in which writers who are sensitive to the period are charged up, the way Mailer and Bellow and Updike are about things happening. And, of course, the greatest writers of our time, like Solzhenitsyn and Beckett and Orwell, are directly almost the creatures of this displacement in historical realm. Yeah. But they all have a problem, and Orwell put that problem at the center in 1984. He originally called the book The Last Man in Europe. The individual has become so teeny-weeny, he's become so small to himself, whether it's because of the psychologism that runs rampant in our age, or whether the psychologism is a result of some historical failures. The fact is that people, as people, do not feel strong in themselves, and the characters that come into contemporary fiction, and drama especially, are just flashes across our life as such, you see. Now, Orwell's problem, 1984, and he wrote about this in his letters to Fred Warburg, his publisher, have to do with the durability of character. Think of Winston Smith, that victim of the ruthless totalitarian machine, a man who was imprisoned for making love, imprisoned for this and that. Think of such a man as the last man in Europe. But that was Orwell's idea. He understood it. You know, Orwell said something, this connection, which oddly enough Karl Marx has said earlier. He said, what's going wrong is that we no longer know absolute right and absolute wrong. And unfortunately, we'll never know it so long as we are consumed by the struggle for economic justice. And Marx himself, of all people, who began as a romantic religious philosopher, the young Marx, says in the manuscripts of that period and everything else, it's a remarkable thing. He says, the world of commercial activity, the world of struggle, the struggle for existence, consumes us so much that we cannot get the real moral universe. That is a real problem. And Orwell added, without knowing perhaps what Marx had said earlier, that the only real question is the question of immortality. I remember my teacher, Mark Van Doren, saying Columbia years ago, I've never forgotten it, he said about Hawthorne. Hawthorne took it for granted that immortality exists. All great writers do, said Mark. But to believe that already shows on what side of the fence you must be, and they did that. And it's no accident that writers like Orwell and Solzhenitsyn and Way and Beckett and others are preoccupied with this question. I mean, what is the meaning of all the rest of it? Well, I mean, immortality, Professor Talton would say that it's all poetry in Emerson, but he really did believe in immortality without assigning it to a very definite place. There's nothing so amazing to our period as to read in Emerson and Thoreau their judgments of the power of the American state. Emerson speaks of the state, the American state, as a poor good beast that means friendly, but he said, if you molest me, I'll cut your throat. Emerson became a terrific fire eater during the Civil War. And it must have been he, with other New England clergymen, who he went to see Lincoln with a company of clergymen, to urge Lincoln to emancipate the slaves before Lincoln felt it was properly time. The point is that one of his clergymen said to Lincoln that they had a call from God to visit him, to tell him that they had the message from God that slavery should be abolished right away. And Lincoln said, don't you think, Chapman, if he was talking to anybody, he would address me first.
This podcast was brought to you by the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU and the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. You can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. For more information, visit us at www.nyihumanities.org.